January 25th, 2009, it's the Watt from Pedro Show.
I'm sorry.
Watt from Pedro Show, January 25th, 2009 edition. Started off show with John Coltrane playing Offering, which actually came out after. It was done in the last year of his life. And then we heard Feedbacker Part 3 by Boris and Brother Matt.
Yeah,
thanks for having us aboard here at the Love Grotto.
Welcome back.
My pleasure point. We have some guests that drove down to Pedro.
Oh, cool.
Hello.
Welcome.
John Frusciani. Josh.
Klinghoffer.
Klinghoffer. Welcome aboard. You've been to Pedro a lot. Well, you came and did a video last year.
Yeah.
Over here at Silicon City,
right? We drove past that on the way here.
Yeah.
Gus Van Sant.
That's right over here.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you come back, you got a hideout here if you need it.
Okay.
Yeah. So, welcome aboard. You made a record.
Yeah. I mean, Josh.
Yeah, you both did.
Yeah.
He was on tour with you.
Yeah, he was playing rhythm guitar and keyboards and some percussion for the last, like, 6 months of the last Chili Peppers tour.
Yeah.
We've probably made, like 7 or 8 solo records. Of my solo records, we've done together. And,
You want them all, Josh?
Yeah, most of them. Yeah. Most of the last.
Last batch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a couple of that didn't when he was, like, on tour with somebody else or something, or... But, like, there was one I did in D.C. that was where I just went there by myself and did that thing with Ian. We've known each other for, like, 11 years, and, I don't know, the album we just made, it's it's just the furthest step in all that everything we've been, like, reaching for and taking it upon ourselves to just, to be doing whatever we want in studios, just gradually, you know, understanding mixing and recording and figuring out ourselves how to get the sounds we're hearing in our head.
What studio did you use?
My home.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a few studio setups in my house, and for this album we used the big one. It was like a big 48 track, 224 track tape machines and big 40 channel API console that used to be at the Record Plant in New York in the 70s, and yeah, it's really cool, old 70s style studio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you call this record?
The Empyrean.
The Empyrean.
Yeah. It's symbolic on a lot of levels of the story, which is kind of has a lot to do with about inner life, the kind of trials you go through inside yourself that really don't ever get even talked about into the outside world or expressed in any way other than in your connection to creativity, you know, and all the ups and downs that come with that and that. So that was the subject matter, and then music was also reflecting the same dynamics of the story. And I just feel like as a record, it was kind of like a peak for us in terms of really being able to have what's coming out of the speakers be what we're hearing in our heads. Because for a long time, we had to translate through other people. So yeah. I also see it as being kind of a peak that me and him have been like working towards for a long time. Flea plays bass on it, and Johnny Marr played guitar in a couple of songs.
When was it done?
It was finished like a year ago.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Finished a year ago?
Almost. Not. You know, I guess we finished it in like April.
Yeah. Okay. We started it in the end of 2007.
Yeah.
No, the end of 2006, I think. Very end of...
The end of 2006?
No.
Christmas, like right around Christmas.
Yeah, it was done over the course of like a year.
End of 2006 is when I was playing with you in Europe.
Yeah, that's right. Because then I was touring.
Yeah.
Remember? missing
it. Yeah, so it was December of 2006, and yeah. Mostly recorded throughout on and off. But, you know, there's probably only a total of about 2.5 months at the most of actual recording and mixing time, but
there was just
huge gaps in between because we were on tour, and when I got home, I was making other kinds of music all the time and didn't want to just do one thing all the time, so... Yeah, it's probably only we record really quickly. This is the most we've ever taken our time making a record, and still it probably only totaled 2.5 months of actual days.
Like what, demo, or just go for it?
No, we had it pretty clear in our heads because our process usually starts where like I'll write a song, and I'll record a version of all the songs that I'm thinking that we're going to have on a particular album.
Just on guitar.
Yeah, just guitar and singing onto a mini disc.
Like a sketch outline.
Yeah, I mean, I usually have the basic arrangement real clear in my head, so I'll just record, like, the whole album is just guitar and singing into my mini disc, and then I'll give Josh a CD of it, and then he just drives around in his car, like, listening to it, making up drum parts in his head and stuff, and then we get together, you know, a few times and refine the, you know, drum parts, but like he pretty much usually has it all mapped out in his head. We think of music real similarly, so it doesn't seem like I ever really play with, like, I don't know, it seems like with him playing drums and Flea playing bass, it was just like not really...
He ain't got TJ.
Yeah, they know where I'm coming from, you know, so we just you know, maybe an accent here or there, but basically, I like to be surprised by what they come up with and stuff. So
So
we just do that, and then we just record them from there. We once made demos, and we didn't really like that. We ended up kind of in the studio just trying to copy the demo.
And we still often like the demo a lot.
Yeah, and we like the demo more. So it's better to enjoy that process of creativity in the studio rather than thinking of it as like you're trying to copy something, which is just like measuring something or something. It's not it's not fun, you know. So with this album there was a lot of like experimentation and
the main basic guitar, drums, bass were done in 3 days, I think.
Yeah, the basic tracks were done super quick. And any other songs we added after that, like the first song was done in like 2 days. Yeah.
Experiment. I want to hear it. Can we hear it some?
Yeah.
in the laboratory. She had the answer. It was a vestigial crystal.
Okay, Live from Pedro Show. We just heard something off John Frusciante's new solo record, The Empyrean, a tune called Dark Light. You want to tell us something about that?
It used to just be the first half of the song, and then just at a certain point, pretty late in the record, decided to have the song carry on and have a completely different feel for the second half. So the first half, sort of lyrically and musically, is sort of symbolic of inner darkness, and the second half is symbolic of inner light.
Yeah. Ah, hence the title.
Yeah,
Dark Light.
And it sounds that way too. Like the first half has kind of a dark sound to it, and the second half is really bright sounding. And this second half is one of the few things that I play all the instruments on the record, where I play bass and I play drum machine and stuff, but like usually it's Flea playing bass and Josh playing drums.
Right.
I'm experimenting a lot with, tripped out.
You had the tune done and like, I want to add more to it.
It was the first half was the whole song, and then just one day it popped into my head a way to continue it on.
And before that we heard Maya Ku by New York Kutanchi. I think it's a father and son.
Wow.
This guy's playing bass. He's like in his mid-40s. And he's got his boy playing with him, half his age. Kind of trippy concept.
Yeah.
father and son. I saw Amit Ali and Rashid Ali like that.
Mm.
Rashid played with the Train.
Yeah.
And Amin, bass player. In fact, at first, he was with James Budd Ulmer.
Mm.
Wild guitars.
Yeah.
And the drummer was a young guy. This is the early 80s. Minutemen got to play with Budd Ulmer. And the drummer is this guy named Calvin Weston, Philadelphia guy. And last year he came out from Philly and played some gigs with him, you know, 25 years later. And he told me, I mean, at least stop bass. Put it away. Mm. Doesn't play it anymore. Guy was monster bass player. Yeah. Like a freight train coming out of his chest. I remember meeting Rashid, and he, his hat was a turtle shell. How you doing? Trippy drummer. Beautiful. Right. Oh, yeah. Before that, we had a band called People with Eyeball Balls Reporting Faster. And then we started that chunk of music. Oh, somebody's leash is gone. With another song from John Frusciante's solo album, Empyrean, Before the Beginning, which is the first track.
Yeah.
Any thoughts?
Want to say something about the first song?
It's called Our Maggot Brain.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was inspired by that idea of having an album have a slow start that kind of invites you into a space rather than pushing itself out at you. But
it's not in a hurry.
Yeah, it's not in a hurry to get anything started and just doing all kinds of tripped out, you know, tripped out backwards effects of different types playing the mixing board like an instrument, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That was like, another one that was done a lot later.
Yeah, it was one of the last things we did, and it was done really quickly, and it was just kind of trying to round out the record. The album already had this song after the ending that seemed like a real specific type of ending, so I figured I wanted to have a specific type of beginning, and I just thought there's not enough records that start out slowly like that. Like Maggot Brain does, people often just try to put their, you know, big people pleaser out front, you know. And so we figured that we'd start kind of in the murky depths of darkness and rise up out of there. And I just, for the whole album, we were really into just trying to do new things with old styles of recording that in terms of doing all tape edits and no automation on the board, but like me and Josh and the engineer Adam would all just be there with our hands on the board,
you know, each other
moves
like that.
And stuff. Yeah, so like it was just like you know, sort of trying to do new things with these old techniques that in a lot of ways have been discarded typically, you know, in the computer world.
Yeah. Did you ever hear about it, the Maggot Brain?
Yeah, George Clinton actually came to my house and I played it for him. That Before the Beginning and another song that has a sort of an early funkadelic influence. There's nothing funk about the record, but mixing wise, I'm real influenced by the sound of their first three records and that sort of haphazard style of mixing. So yeah, George Clinton's kind of like, he told me about like.
Him telling
what he was
Hazel.
Doing, yeah, when they were doing that track.
Saying, like, your mother died.
You should play like your mother died, yeah. Yeah. You ever hear the original version of that? It's like...
With the whole band.
Yeah, it's a whole band.
It was done in the mix with mute buttons. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he just mixed it like... Yeah, I guess he made like the people in the... You know, like the bass player was like, you took away the groove of the song, you know. But it's, to me, it is Billy Bass's groove and the drummer's groove, you know. It's like a... It was that way a lot on our record because we do basic tracks with me playing rhythm guitar and some songs like that didn't have drums. The basic track that we didn't use a click. It would be like play to the groove of my guitar, but we didn't use my rhythm guitar on most things, you know.
Yeah, we replaced it with the stuff that had a lot less time, you know, like a temporal structure.
Yeah, but it's still, that's the groove that's running through everything. I like those kind of invisible connectors. A lot of people use a click track that way, but when it's an actual human groove, it really creates an unusual link between all the overdubs and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you're saying all this experiment in the real time. You know, your first solo record. You ever think about that when you do these things?
Yeah.
That was really good. Man, that record is wild.
Thanks, yeah. I did a four-track thing when I was making this record that sounds exactly like it would have been on my first record. My head is at a pretty similar place. In a lot of ways, I feel like what I did on this record is very similar in a lot of ways to what I would have wanted to do then if I would have known how to use a studio, because it's a pretty psychedelic album, and that was where my head was at that time, and there's a lot of what I was listening to, and I just tried to be that trippy on a four-track, you know, with just, like, guitar and voice and backwards, you know, flipping the tape over and stuff like that, but yeah, I feel like in a lot of ways I was trying to produce those same kind of effects on the psyche of the listener with this is what I was doing then. I mean, and also like my state of mind when I made that stuff on my first record, I wasn't imagining people ever hearing it. And even though when we started making this record, I was thinking of it like a record, eventually it just became something to play late at night in my living room, to trip my head out and to try to mix in such a way that I would have fun listening to it over and over, because I'm just going, whoa, you know, like, and play it when my friends come over and stuff, just to trip people's heads out. Like, it's not, I'm sort of good at tricking myself that way, I guess. I stopped really even thinking about that it was something that was going to be released. And
yeah, we didn't hurry at all, that's what.
Yeah, we weren't in any kind of a hurry. It really ended up being done in that same kind of spirit as my first record, where I was making it and thinking this is just for me and my friends.
Not Mersh.
Yeah.
I love that record, man. That's wild. It made me think a little bit of Sid Barrett.
I was really into Sid Barrett at that time.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that Piper. But then the other two, the Madcap and Aaron
Barrett.
Trippy records.
Yeah, they kind of because the whole time I was playing guitar as a teenager, I really wasn't into acoustic guitar. It was forced on me when I started playing. I had to play acoustic guitar because my parents wouldn't buy me an electric, and I had to prove myself on acoustic. And I think I didn't do anything with acoustic guitar for like the first 9 years that I was playing guitar. But when I was 21, and I'd had those Sid Barrett albums for a while, but I got obsessed with them I'd had them since I was like 15, but I got obsessed with them when I was like 21, and it made me become really into writing songs on acoustic guitar and recording. It just made me see acoustic guitar, you know, as something that it's a privilege to play instead of as something that you have to play.
The burden. Oh, wow. So, when you were coming up with the songs to show the Josh, Flea, and those guys, jamming them out, or in your mind, you had like the rhythm guitar is going to be a tool to show them, but I have an idea.
You know, I write the music and the lyrics, you know, chords and lyrics and melody all at once. It's always been one process with me.
But you ever think like, I'll show the guys the guitar and we'll have that guide track, then I'll lose it?
That was the idea, because I was really, I was really at that time, I was really enjoying records like the first couple of Roxy Music records and the Doors in the 60s, where the guitar, unlike in most rock music, it's not playing a prominent role. It's more playing like embellishments on top, and it's more, Josh got really good on the organ and electric pianos and stuff like that in the last few years. He was playing that in a couple of bands that he was on tour with, where I just was really liking I'd never really used those instruments much on my solo records, and then it started to just seem like a good idea to make music that was more where the keyboards are the more the thing that's playing the chords, and if there's a guitar, it's more something on top of it. And then that takes the song away from its original conception. A lot of these songs, when they started, they sounded like kind of just very, very different than they do now. Like now, the chords are all kind of difficult to place, whereas they were. I used to be really into making like complicated chord progressions and stuff in my songs, and this was like going back to just like major and minor chords and stuff like that. But if I would have used guitar as the main thing, it might have even sounded kind of stock or something like that. But with the keyboards, you don't even hear what the original conception of the song was. You just hear the textures that it's being pulled out of, and all.
You don't often hear the original form of the keyboard either. We would treat it from
there. Yeah, we would do electronic treatments to the keyboard. So the actual end thing is so far from the original
Well, like Groove. Like Groove, the process.
Yeah.
It would not be like the same.
Yeah, that's especially why making demos of the things wouldn't have worked, because we really used the studio as the compositional tool and as the arrangement tool. We'd fill up all the tracks with all kinds of ideas and then gradually figure out, okay, because we would edit each section, we would mix each song in sections, like, and do tape edit. So it would be like, okay, for the first section, we're just going to use strings and bass and the electric piano and the vocal, and then the next section we'll have drums and whatever it is, like we'll have this guitar melody here, and we'll use these reverb effects. Each section was mixed like it was its own song, you know. So it would be a different combination, huh?
Should play Central next.
Central's the peak of that, because we started to realize we could really get away with these crazy edits you wouldn't think would work. But
that's why when Brother Man asked you about Tor, it'd be a little.
Yeah, no, because it's all made of edits. It would
be
very different
thing to try and do. But
yeah, it would be the songs in a different form. There's no way we could reproduce what we did on the record, you know. But we could do something interesting. But yeah, it was like we gradually started to realize that like you could get away with really drastic edits as long as there's one element that stays the same. Everything else can change, and we didn't figure that out till. Late, and up till then we were like, oh, make sure nothing moves of any of the tracks, and then eventually we were like, remove everything but one thing, you know, and it worked, you know, as long as that keyboard part doesn't sound like it's changed, you believe it when everything else changes place, you know. So we would have, if we would have made demos, we would have had no idea where it was going, and we would have probably fallen in love with it in some form that we would have felt like we had to adhere to.
We did even, there's a couple times where we made rough mixes in, say, January, and then when we started working again on it in July, and we were going back to those old rough mixes, and we wound up killing ourselves trying to recreate it, and we would move on from that, but...
Happened. Sandra, the first hour, January 25th, 2009, out from Pedro Show. Hold tight for hour two. We got a jam coming. January 25th, 2009. It's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show.
Never end.
Bought from Pedro Show. Started off the second hour with The Sea by Daughters of Fission, Arizona band. And then I'm Gonna Marry You by Connect Nine. And something from Brother Dale, Uno for Dos, what he called a tribute, Do One Bass for Two. And then something new from John Frusciante's solo album, The Empyrean, called God. And now we come to that point of show for Brother Matt's Spin Cycle. And special edition because we get to jam with Josh and John. And Watt's even going to play bass, which I don't do much. I do it in the Shuka, right? Did I do it another time? I can't remember another time. At least once or twice, but this is rare.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, because I'm always talking so much, and you, like, they got to hear me play bass, too. You know? So, usually it's my guess. But I consider it an honor and privilege to get to jam with you folks. So, and Brother Matt. So, without further ado or hitting the mic, here we go with our jam. We'll be right back.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
January 25th, 2009, it's the third hour of the Watford Pedro Show. We just heard Brother Matt Spinsigel with guest Josh, John,
yeah.
Myself, trying to make it happen in a moment.
Watford Pedro
Show. Hey, can I play a song by this group Warpaint that I mixed their record?
And
to, like, open the bruise up and let some of the blues blood come out to show them.
Come on, 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 come on Thank you.
Bought from Pedro Show. Started a third hour off with Elephants by War Paint. John, that's something you just mixed?
Yeah, about a year ago, actually, but it's just coming out
just
now.
A year ago.
Yeah.
Just about a year ago.
The Imperium was finished. Yeah, it was done like exactly right after we were done with the Imperium.
The Imperium?
We started mixing War Paint.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Imperium.
It means the highest point in heaven.
Yeah. It's in the Divine Comedy.
Right.
It's one of the... Yeah, really up there. It's where the choir is. It's kind of where Beatrice disappears. She ain't at the very end. She goes and sits near Mary. It's like St. Bernard, I think, ends up taking him to the last gig. Show. Floor show. Imperium, but like empirical.
Are the words connecting?
Maybe empirical means something.
Right, high up.
You can measure.
Yeah, but
empirical.
But Imperium is specifically, I think.
Imperium was, level above. Because they thought the planets were around us. So it was above the levels of the planets, because we were in the center.
Yeah, it's supposed to be the highest point of the highs.
Yeah. We were. The idea was we didn't go around the sun. Everything went around us.
Right.
The Imperium was way out there. In fact, that's his levels of heavens. They're different planets. There's different, his trip.
Yeah, that's something, since it's pretty impossible to conceive of space ending at some point, but at the same time, it's just as difficult to imagine it going on endlessly. So
I know.
I guess the Imperium is a way of sort of...
You mean like infinities?
Yeah, you can't. It's impossible to picture space ending at a point, but it's also impossible to picture it going on forever. And the Imperium is a way of sort of.
Come on, stop, Mr. Coltrane.
of conceiving of a highest point that could be or something.
Yeah, I mean, some infinities are bigger than others.
Hmm.
Which is kind of hard to conceive of.
Yeah.
Like the set of all numbers, right? Yeah. They go on forever.
Yeah.
They're always going to be bigger than the set of odd numbers.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, it's always going to be twice as big, but there's
right,
no...
Right, but it keeps going.
It's twice as big.
See, I don't know how to work these leashes. So what I do is just hang up on the dude. There must be a way to, silence him, right, without throwing it, crashing against the wall. So, but that is trivia. The Imperium, a high point... And like you were saying about the inner light.
Yeah,
inner
it's about reaching for stuff that's sort of beyond your grasp, but that you keep...
Maybe a
charging. Some kind of something inside yourself or something, whatever it is that drives your imagination to keep striving to sort of become one with that energy more and more so in all your actions in your life or like people in science or in religion where you're constantly sort of reaching for things that can't completely be understood or attained, but it doesn't stop whatever that force is inside you that drives you to want to know more and learn more and do more and,
Yeah.
It's about some of the records kind of involve some of the struggles that you go through inside as a creative person just trying to, trying to become one with something that you don't really understand, that doesn't really have any concrete form that you can grasp onto, but that you're born with this incentive to do something, whether it's playing music or painting or whatever it is,
Yeah, you paint too.
I used to, yeah.
No more?
Not anymore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, about 10 years ago I decided to limit myself to the things that I felt I had most aptitude for because I'd spent about 5 years concentrating on things that I didn't have a lot of aptitude for. It was a good learning experience, and it was something good to keep me connected to the artistic force for other reasons besides that I was making a living at it or something, I kind of stopped doing it in the situations where I had any value to the public and started just following my creativity, and I think it was a good period of time for me, but when I sort of came back into the world, as it were, I just really wanted to focus on writing songs and playing
music.
Guitar and learning about, electronic music from time to time and stuff.
I got an interview with John Coltrane. He says all musicians are after some kind of truth.
Yeah, you're trying. I feel like we're all expressing things that really can't be expressed any other way. We're expressing truth when something sounds good to our ear, when something connects to our soul. I feel like it's saying something to us, but it's not something that we can put into words. And I think in some ways, they can probably be reduced to some kind of mathematical formulas, but no musician's conscious of that. You just sort of decide, I'm going to play this note this hard at this particular exact point in time. You know, it's all reducible to numbers, but we're driven, like the organization of it. If something's too many numbers off, it's going to be off time. And if it's within a certain margin, then we hear it is on time. If it's a little late, it depending on where you are in the song, it's going to be a good groove. And it can be analyzed that way, but we do it purely on intuition and feeling and emotion and the setup of our muscles and stuff, and we don't really know what we're saying, but we know when it means something. And it's just an odd
interactions, you know, too, between people, because then you got more.
A lot of times music expresses the
because you call them solo albums, but you collaborate.
Oh yeah, it's just because I write the songs, and I'm, you know, like, and so and producing and stuff. But we actually made one album that was a collaboration. We could play something off that if maybe. We made one song where it was both of us writing the songs and stuff, and
well, collaborating with the write.
Yeah, where some songs were Josh's and some were mine, you know, probably if I wasn't so busy in the band over the last, you know, 10 years, we would have done stuff like that more often. But you know, it seemed like I was always so anxious to make solo records anytime there was a little break.
So
that's what we would do.
Yeah, the need for solo records. Yeah. I think it's great. You know?
Yeah, you know, I've always just spent all my time recording since I was a kid, so it's kind of more natural for me to do that than it is to do a band. You know, a band has been something more that I sort of settled into. It didn't come naturally at first. I'm much more comfortable just working by myself and calling the shots and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about how you got to music, but, oh yeah, we, after Elephants, well, yeah, you didn't tell me how you got involved with that.
Oh,
how'd you end up mixing?
They're just friends of mine, and Josh played drums on one song, and I played mellotron on one song, and they had recorded a record, and they needed someone to mix it, and I was so sort of hot on the mixing.
You're in mix mode.
My friend Adam started forgetting that I played guitar, the engineer who was doing it with us, because he was so used to me being the guy on the mixing board and stuff. I'd play guitar and stuff, and he'd be like, I forgot you're so good on guitar. I really love the band and stuff. They make music that really expresses things that I feel inside me, so it was a pleasure.
You
to
want
answer.
To get in on it. Yeah. Like Omar. Had you be a guitar player for him?
Yeah, I've played on all their albums except their first EP. I just did another one in August.
Does he play on it? I mean, there's one where he didn't play, right?
Well, no, he played, but he played like overdubs. Like I played, there's two where I play most of the written guitar parts.
Yeah.
And then he did additional parts on top of that, but like tracking with the drummer or... I guess it was just one where for the whole album I played all those parts, but even on the next one I did after that, the last one that was released, I did pretty similar, you know, where I'm playing a lot of written parts.
I think that's really righteous that you would say, yeah, guide me.
Oh, it's fun, yeah, because I've spent so much time, you know, concentrating on practicing guitar, just learning things off records and things like that, to be able to apply that skill that I have of being able to learn something and then play it, and just have it being just like how hard I'm hitting the guitar, how I'm expressing myself through the part, rather than like thinking of the notes and the rhythms. It's just fun. When I was a kid, I thought I would be in Frank Zappa's band when I grew up, you know? so I kind of wanted to have a situation like that where I'm playing some like, you know, sort of difficult to play music and on time signatures and stuff, and just like, locking into it and stuff.
Like the challenge of it.
Yeah, it's just, it's fun. And yeah, and the one we just did, I guess they're probably about to mix it right now. That came out really cool. They're going in a new direction.
Mars Volta.
Really exciting. Mm-hmm.
We heard Can't Take That Away by Animal Train and some Young Cats. And then you guys played Come Out by Steve Reich.
Yeah.
Thoughts on that?
Want to talk about Come Out? Come Out, yeah, it's an experiment, I guess, in phasing that he did with tape recorders in the 60s, where he just takes a loop of, I think it's an injured kid or something talking. I'm not sure who the kid is, but it's almost like, you know, what people would do with sampling now and with a lot of, you know, with effects and things like that. But he's just doing it, from what I understand, just with tape recorders. It's just some of the magic that can that can come. And especially it shows all the incredible incredibly rich harmonics that are in the human voice. And some people have even more complex ones than others, and he pulls all kinds of incredible sounds and rhythms and melodies out of this one single phrase of the person repeated over and over. I just
five words.
Yeah, come out to show them. And Captain Beefheart also quoted that in the songs. Yeah, on this last song on the first side. I'm forgetting the name of the song. I remember the drum fill at the beginning, but yeah. So I like Steve Reich.
Yeah, who would we play? That lady.
Oh yeah,
came
lady.
Up with the Doctor Who theme song. Mm. She's working the BBC studios in the 50s and 60s, and they had to cut tape and no synthesizers. Use oscillators.
Yeah,
and mainly a lot of tape manipulation.
Totally, yeah.
Speeding up, slowing down.
A friend of mine said that's his. Aaron says that's like his favorite song.
Somebody asked him
that. I don't know what it sounds like. I've read about it.
Sounds. Yeah, what's her name? Danbury, her last name.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. I don't remember her name.
She just died a few years ago, but it was a pretty trip far ahead. There were no peers, no status quo. They were just pioneers.
Yeah,
getting started in music. Your journey. Where did it start?
I guess it was like... first, like hearing some music when I was 4 years old, where I realized that that it was resonating something inside me that I was connected to. It was like showing me something about the inside of myself that I didn't know before that. So there was that experience which felt important when I was like four, and then. Growing up, being about 7, 8 years old, and hearing music in my head, and thinking like, "Wow, what is this music that's going through my head? Like, it sounds like
not from the radio.
No music I was making up, but with no effort. I was just hearing music that I would want to hear in my head, and thinking, "Wow, if I could play an instrument, I could write some cool songs." You know, like, but they were just there in my head, like planted in there or something. It didn't feel like something that I was thinking of or anything. It would just be like being bored walking down the street and entertaining yourself by like hearing music in your head, you know? And so that made me feel, the fact that happened so much made me feel like I was meant to play an instrument. And then I just always had that in my head. Even from before I knew what a guitar was, I knew that I was going to play guitar. So the more I started to hear guitars on records and know what they were, know who Jimmy Page was and know who Eddie Van Halen was or whatever, the more I started really wanting to play guitar really badly, and tried when I was about 8, but nobody would buy me an electric, and I didn't like the way acoustic sounded, so I waited until I just had to play. I was like killing me to not play, so I played acoustic for a while just to prove to my dad that I could play, and I was just learning punk songs by ear, you know.
It was off records?
Yeah, off records, at first I don't even think I knew how to tune it. I was just playing all the chords with one finger and tuning it to where it sounded like what was on the records to me, you know, it was good. I convinced my dad that I was gonna stick with it and stuff, and so he bought me a Stratocaster, which was what I wanted. By then I was also getting really into Jimi Hendrix and stuff, and then
in an amp.
Yeah, so he got me a little Roland amp and a Stratocaster, and I started, it was good because my taste was always going along with my ability. Like, I started out learning punk songs, and that was what I was really into, and it was also a pretty easy thing to learn how to play, you know, and then I got into 60s music, and then I got into, like, progressive rock, and I was really into Frank Zappa, and, you know, it was just like, I had between the ages of 12 and 16, it was like my taste kept getting more complex, and my ability was growing with my taste, so I never tried to play things that were way beyond me. I always was playing just things that were just a little beyond my ability and stuff.
What about other people? Did you know people at school playing?
Yeah, I didn't. Them? Not really. I didn't play with a lot of people. I mostly just sat in my bedroom and practiced all the time. I was. You know, it would be anywhere between. It was pretty much all I did besides eat and maybe, you know,
piss
sitting
shit
at somebody. Yeah, just sitting at somebody. Maybe go over to somebody's house and watch. You know. Watch videos or something like that, but usually it was just like practice every second that I could. Sleep in school sometimes, like go to school and fall asleep on the couch and wake up when it was time to go home. You know, they let you do that in my school, so I took advantage. I would stay up practicing all night and drink tons of coffee and then go to school.
Be a whole wore out.
Yeah, so.
So it was a lot of listening to records and playing to them.
Yeah, I mean, that's everything. I feel like everything that I've done has had a lot. Josh is also really big on that. We both know how to have such a backlog of songs that we know how to play to get, like, from off of records, that where it's a nice kind of shared knowledge, because we have. It gives you a good sort of idea of why things. You gradually start to put together why things make you feel what they make you feel, you know, like when sometimes if I don't know how to play something, it's like, oh, that's a color that I don't know how to express or something. And then you learn how to play it and you develop a sort of vocabulary of knowing which feelings can be produced by which combinations of notes and which rhythms and which, one instrument offsetting another instrument and balancing
interaction.
Out. Yeah, so I'm big on learning like as many of the parts as I can, and I don't just learn guitar things. I've spent a lot of time learning like John Coltrane song, you know, heads and Ornette Coleman heads and, you know, Eric Dolphy. I go through periods of just learning things on other instruments, or I've spent a lot of time learning things that were made on sequencers, learning parts off electronic music records of all types, and learning, you know, so starting to see the guitar not just as a guitar, but just picking up the logic of other instruments, because it's a completely different logic on piano. Piano is a real difficult one to play on guitar, but you try to learn somebody's chord progressions on piano and play them on guitar, it teaches you a lot. Or learn like classical music and try to understand the relationship of all the parts and all that. So for me, like that's been. It seems like the styles that I've developed have been just various ways of crossing together and combining feelings of various things that aspects of things that I like, and putting them all together, kind of like somebody makes a hip hop track or something, where you just like. You take a beat from one thing and a guitar from another thing, and you just sort of blend together a lot of things, and that's kind of how my music has been. I I get inspired by learning things off records, and I don't, it makes me happy to do. I've never, you know, as a kid, I don't know, I think I always had my own voice, but I remember a kid who didn't really seem to care that much about music telling me, hey, you should be original, you're better than this person or that person that you look up to so much, and I would be like, no, I'm not, and you know, and I love learning their stuff, like, there's no reason I would not do this, and gradually I developed.
Yeah, when did you write your first songs?
Oh, right away.
Oh, that, right
that
away.
Was the, it was actually the first thing I did, but it made me take it more seriously when I started learning other people's songs, you know. But I emotionally, I had to do it right from the beginning, so that was the day I started playing guitar. I was mad at a kid, and I just went into my house and wrote all these songs about, like, I want to kill him. And, you know, I must have I filled up, like, a whole tape and wrote the name of every song that I wrote on the cassette tape, and it was just one, I think, I don't have the tape anymore, but it was like, I think it was just one angry song after another of just these punk songs about this kid and about stuff I was mad about, but it made me feel better. I had been going through sort of a rough period where I was sort of imbalanced, lost, and I got that initial aggression out playing music, and then I very quickly went into a period of just being a real peaceful person who, you know, loved the ideals of the 60s and things like that, you know, and just wanted to make music that felt good, and went into a very arty period after that of things like, you know, and Talking Heads. So my first 4-track recordings were all real kind of arty experimental things.
Did you make a band when you were young?
No, I had conceptual bands in my recordings and stuff.
But like no gigs?
No. I played a show with my guitar teacher. That was my first live experience, was playing a bunch of feedback on a cover of a 60s song they were covering. He had kind of a psychedelic, modern psychedelic band, and it was kind of a feature for the guitar. I did all this soloing, long solos and feedback and stuff on this one song while he just sang, and that was a lot of fun. But yeah, other than that, I mean, there really wasn't, you know, I didn't really know kids I could see eye to eye with.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of kids who wanted to do the same kind of thing, and people seemed to be very concerned with what other people would think what we would do, and they weren't thinking in terms of, like, following interests. They were thinking in terms of, like, I want girls to like me at parties and stuff like that. And
yeah,
so somebody like me who is thinking totally in musical terms of wanting to do something weird or wanting to do something different, they didn't see any place for that. So there was
pure.
Yeah.
Pure.
Yeah, I loved the making of music. So, you know, people didn't, you know, I felt whenever I would try to play with people, I definitely had experiences, but I felt me and them felt totally disconnected from one another. You know, they thought I was too serious about recording sometimes, or sometimes they thought what I wanted to do was too weird. So I pretty much just focused on practicing. I figured when I moved to Hollywood, I would probably find some people who were more suited to playing with me, and I did right away. I met a really great bass player when I moved to Hollywood, and he was the first person who I really started developing a real musical communication with, you know. He died a few years later, but he really, you know, he was the first person who I had the kind of connection like I have with Josh, or that I had with Flea or Omar or whatever. Like, I had that with him first, and That was a great experience.
Yeah, maybe it was so good. That's how you extended it to these cats after him.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird the way the universe pushes people together. You know, I feel like when you're ready and you meet the people who you're meant to play with, it sometimes happens like magic. You might never go out during a certain period of time, and you go out one time and you meet somebody who becomes like a lifelong, you know, musical partner. I can't help but feel like there's a plan sometimes, because it's weird how I didn't meet anybody who I had that kind of connection with as a kid, and then in my adult life I've slowly, you know, I've probably known like 5 people like that who I feel like I have a really yeah. you know, born connection with. But
that's pretty bold moving out to out here when you hadn't felt it yet.
Well, I knew I wanted to be a musician, and I felt like Hollywood was the place to.
Where were you at before?
Chatsworth.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, not too far.
No, I was. It's very far in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. you know,
light years.
yeah, it's the Deep Valley, and it's just nothing going on there, and people. You know, it was good. It kept me in my bedroom
thermos
practicing.
Bottle.
You know,
thermos bottle.
Yeah, because people were very.
Well, when it comes to working on yourself, maybe you need distraction.
Yeah, I'm not sure what would happen if I would have grown up in Mar Vista where I lived before that. Like, I in Mar Vista, it seemed like there was, you know, I knew some cool older kids and,
right.
you know, like had a friend who was into punk and stuff. And, like, I moved to Chatsworth, and the fact that I was punk was just...
Yeah,
like
solitary confinement,
unheard of. You know, people thought I was so weird and had the nickname Punker John, and didn't like that. and just like, you know, it just made me feel like a real outcast. And
ostracized.
I think more and more, I went through a weird phase of just trying to be kind of normal for a while and fit in, and then I gave up on that and just focused on making music in my bedroom over, you know, all the time and. Let myself be as weird as I actually am, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, this is interesting. So it's hard to really plan the life journey.
Yeah, I think it's more important just to follow your heart. Mm-hmm. I think when somebody's goal is to sort of to succeed at something in some way or to when they're thinking of it in terms of I want to be seen by the outside world like this or that, I feel like it's sending all kinds of weird mixed messages to your inner self. I think you'll get what you want out of life as long as you're clear about what it is that you want. You know, if that's all you want, yeah, there's plenty of steps you can take to do that. But if you really love music, I think just following your heart and playing the music that you're interested in and just putting every, you know, bit of energy into every day towards that one idea of wanting to merge with that force that music comes from, the universe has really skillful, exacting ways of putting you in the place that you need to be at the right time to play with the people who you're meant to play with, you know, and I think it only, you know, it only comes from some kind of inner confusion about the reasons that you're doing it when you don't get what you want. I think it just comes from some, you know, I feel like my mindset was always just like, I want to make music that, you know, that I feel good about making. I just want to, you know, it wouldn't have made a difference in my mind whether I was in a, you know, in a club band or if I was a rock star or something like it, that was a total non-issue to me. Like, I wanted to make, you know, music that I liked and that I felt good about, and that was something I was always doing anyway, so it just seemed like,
yeah.
I just always felt like, you know, if it's good music, there's always going to be some people who want to hear it, you know, and the other stuff just wasn't important to me, you know.
I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think sometimes some people are in a sort of a state of confusion where you're motivated by sort of a, you know, and to some degree, you know, I can't say that, like, you know, I've gotten sucked into it too, where you're kind of, you lose a little of your focus on what you're hearing on your inside, and you're concerned about what these people think or what those people think, and
outside.
And I feel like that's the enemy there, you know. You've really got to listen to what's, because I feel like music comes through inner channels inside yourself. Mm-hmm. When, just like I was saying, when I was a kid, I would just hear it in my head. It wasn't
right.
Like I was trying to think of a song, and that's how songwriting is. It's, you just have to listen to what's going on in your head. You don't try to write a song. And I think that's why a lot of the time people who write really good pop songs, a lot of the time the good song it's the only good song on the whole album because they're not really listening. They're just trying to achieve something. And I think it's fine if that's the goal, if that's what you're trying to do. But I've always tried hard to listen to what's inside me and to follow my ever-changing interests that are on the inside and to conform to some degree to the situation like being in a band like I was in was really about like, okay, how can I bend this or twist this or push this in this direction or that, but it's still ascribing to the previous energy of the, you know, what the Red Hot Chili Peppers is, and then see in which directions can we move this and bend it and stuff. And that's all, you know, that's another way of listening to what's on the inside of you to conform it to a specific musical situation. But my favorite thing is just to really listen to what's inside myself without any consideration of who's going to hear it or where it's going or what place it has in the world or whether people would think it's good or not. Like, more and more, I just don't think that stuff matters, you know. My favorite times in my life have been where I've just been making music for no other reason than just to do it. And I think it's important to always stay in touch with that part of yourself, even if you are in a band with people and some of the people are, you know, wanting to have their mind on other things other than just the making the music, to make sure that you, at least for yourself, stay connected to the musical source by having a good amount of activity that you're doing that's 100% just because you like doing it, you know.
Yeah. Wise words. Thank you, John.
For real.
Much respect. Let's play some tunes.
The barracks by the corner light, I'll always stand and wait for you at night. We will create a world for two. I'll wait for you the whole night through, for you, Lily Marlene, for you, Lily Marlene. Bugler tonight, don't play the call to arms. I want another evening with her charm. Then we will say goodbye and part. I'll always keep you in my heart. With me, Lily Marlene. With me, Lily Marlene. Give me a rose to show how much you care. Tie to the stem a lock of golden hair. Surely tomorrow you'll feel blue, but then will come a love that's new. For you, Lily Marlene. For you, Lily Marlene. Marching in the mud and cold, and when my pack seems more than I can hold, my love for you renews my might. I'm warm again, my pack is light. It's you, Lily Marlene. It's you, Lily Marlene. My love for you renews my might. I'm warm again, my pack you, Lily Marlin. It's you, Lily
for Pedro show. We heard Marlena Dietrich with Lil Marlena, and then we heard Enough of Me from John Frusciante's solo record Empyrean, along with Josh. And I thank you both for coming down to Pedro.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, great having you.
Gracing us with the wise words and the righteous jams and your spirits.
Definitely.
It's January 25th, 2009 edition of Watt from Peter Show. Brother Matt, thank you very much for essential aiding and abetting. Everybody, keep your powder dry.
Yeah.